It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. I'm Kirk.
And I'm John. How you doing?
Yeah, you got it this time.
I know. It's the perfect timing.
Perfect timing. Very snappy.
How you doing now during this wonderful Christmas season?
Doing all right. It got very cold, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's all right.
We knew that was coming. Come on. I mean, we're badgers. We're cheeseheads. We're used to this. So it was
we've been fortunate that the weather's been so nice. It's time to be a little cold.
Actually, the fall was gorgeous, I thought.
It was. Absolutely.
So, not complaining. Anyway.
Yeah, well, good. I'll complain. All right, so what have you been up to? What did you do this week?
What did I do this week? I had a bunch of hearings, and which is what I do. And I also did a bunch of Christmas shopping and bought for my nieces and nephews a bunch of presents and wrapped them. So it was rather festive. And you?
Very good. Hey, I saw I was in court quite a bit. I also had a bit of a weird thing going on with my I have like vertigo, you know?
Ooh.
And I went to the doctor, and at first they thought I was having a stroke or something, and I wasn't, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. But the doctor said that there's been like five other people that have come in the office in the past week that have the same sort of thing. It's like a virus, but the only symptom is you get dizzy. So
is this related to the election, you think?
It could be.
I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but so I'm not trying to diagnose you here, but, you know, seems the timing seems a little fishy, is what I'm saying.
It could be.
Well, how do you feel now? I mean, are you able to do the
good.
Show?
I
do
feel
you
want good.
Do you want to just lay down for the rest of the show while I just talk?
And you can just talk?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could do that. I'll just lie down here on the table here at WHBL Studios. I did notice something very interesting that happened earlier this week, and another round of clemency petitions were granted by President Obama.
Yes.
And he's been granting a lot of them. And I noticed if you go on the Clemency Project website, it gives you very detailed information. I did notice that there's only one out of the past – I've looked at maybe 500 or so cases. There's only one from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Maybe
is that right?
Yeah, there's quite a few from the Western District. But they're almost all – crack cocaine cases that he's granting clemency on. And when you go and look at the details, it's very interesting because by and large, the way that these things are being granted is if someone's been in for at least 10 years and they got a very, very serious sentence, as in, you know, 30 or 40 years on up, what they've been doing is reducing the sentence to either time served or close to time served with the condition that they have added to their extended supervision or, you know, what do they call it in federal court again? I'm drawing a blank here.
Supervised release.
Supervised release. Yes. It's a different acronym.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Right. So with the condition that they enter into a residential treatment program, which I think is brilliant, you know. So I have a couple of clients out there that I'm hoping the clemency petition will reach his desk and he'll be able to make a decision before time's up, which is coming pretty soon. And I don't anticipate there's going to be a whole lot of clemency from the tough-on-crime president-elect.
No, I think zero would be more accurate, especially with Jeff Sessions at the helm of the Justice Department. So,
yeah, we talked about that last
week. Yes, we did. And, you know, I think it's great what the president's doing and directing these, you know, these efforts at clemency, and I only have one, I guess, hesitation, and that is, yes, okay, we're getting people, you know, from these ridiculously long sentences, we're getting them reduced and or released, and they're back in the community. But you know what? They're still convicted felons,
right?
And at the end of the day, boy, I'll tell you, if you want something to really short circuit your ability to live a decent life, try being a convicted felon. Right. You know, I mean, housing, jobs, and just social
voting
and just being a social pariah in essence, you know, and so it's a form of disenfranchisement that's that I think should be somehow built into the calculus. I don't know how, I don't know what form you could do that. Like, could he say, all right, I'm going to commute this sentence, and then at the end of the sentence, I'm going to grant a pardon automatically or something like that.
That would be excellent, actually. But, you know, people in public, in our public view of crime and the law, I don't think we'll ever support that. I don't think we'll ever have a legislator that has the foresight and wisdom to support such a thing. I mean, maybe. I don't know. But I think the public tends to complain when they find out that somebody has been convicted of a felony and they didn't know it, especially if their record is wiped clean, you know, for all the same reasons that we know people are discriminated against based on something that is probably factual, you know,
yeah.
Having committed a crime at some point. But, you know, this is nothing new. It's always been part of practically every society that has a criminal justice system. And we used to, you know, have people – well, now we have people that live in designated neighborhoods and can't live in certain places. And they have massive supervision, sometimes even GPS.
GPS monitoring, yeah.
For the rest of their lives in some cases. But even going back before then, we had leper colonies, you know. if somebody was not part of the society that we want,
we put them
in a different place.
Yeah, some people would argue that the pilgrims and other such groups that came over to the new country were exactly that. They were just sort of outcasts.
And Australia was a place where England sent all of its criminals.
The dumping ground, sure.
Right. So that's what I see is going to happen with Mars. You know, we're going to get to the point where...
Now, that's too bad.
Set all the sex offenders
I was
Mars.
Looking forward to going there. Man.
Well, you could still go. Well, it's not...
I guess it's big enough. Yeah, sure. But, you know, there's no internet. There's not a lot of infrastructure. And so...
Not yet.
But, you know... It's this, you know, a felony used to be a horrible, horrible thing because it was rare, right? I mean,
and it was reserved for violent crimes. And
exactly. And so people were right in most cases to think, okay, you're a felon, then you really did something wrong. But now I think it's lost a lot of its power, hasn't it? I mean, if you hear somebody as a felon, then you could be a felon for a second possession of marijuana, you know?
Well, just to pick up on what you said before about President Obama exercising his clemency power, well, I'll remind you that during at least the first two years of his first term, no action whatsoever on any clemency petitions. And granted, this is part of a new project that was formed in order to address the prison overcrowding issue, which became more of a forefront issue later in his...
He was evolving on this issue.
He was evolving on the issue. But, you know, another thing that I can say about President Obama that has led to the same problem we're dealing with is that during his administration, the federal government has created thousands of new felonies that didn't exist before, many of which have no mens rea requirement, all in the guise of cracking down on quote-unquote white-collar crime.
Right, right.
And which it's a problem because it doesn't apply just to white-collar people.
Right, which the Supreme Court has pushed back on a couple of cases, appropriately so. Because, I mean, the whole idea of the structure of the criminal law writ large is because we want to have that – intent element. You have to...
And you want to have notice of what you're doing,
yes,
if
absolutely.
It's against the law or not. Because, you know, I learned this in the military, and the concept of good order and discipline, that's a catchphrase you always hear. It's one of the incentives to enforce the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But in order to achieve an ideal state of good order and discipline, you have to make sure that it's done uniformly and fairly because, and it's been proven, at times when commanders did not exercise their authority appropriately and simply came down hard on everyone, it has a negative effect on good order and discipline. Just like in society, if you fear that you will be arbitrarily prosecuted, you have no incentive to obey the law. In fact, the difference between obeying the law and not obeying the law becomes obscured, and it leads to generally people being more dissatisfied with life, society, being an American, etc. And, you know, it never occurs to people until it hits home. And so many people come into my office that never thought they'd be walking into a criminal defense lawyer's office in a million years, and something happened, and here they are, you know. In fact, most people that I meet with have never even imagined that it would be necessary for them to consult with a criminal defense lawyer. But it happens just like death and taxes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there has to be some clarity. I mean, without that, nobody knows what the rules are. I mean, it's just like it's as, almost as if there is no rule.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, we got to take a break. You're right. You're absolutely right. We're going to take a break, and we hope you listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John on WHBL, and hope you listened closely to those fine messages from our sponsors. So, Kirk, we were talking about this whole issue of clemency and what Obama's done. What do you see coming forward in the next, what is it, 3-4 weeks? Well, no, I guess it's more than that, 6-7 weeks that are left until January 20th.
Well, practically every president, including both Bushes, I believe, have exercised clemency power in their lame duck period. And I expect there will be more. But, you know, President Obama's been kind of unique in the sense that he's started exercising what would otherwise be considered a great deal of clemency power. But again, it's a specific issue this time around. It's not just favors. You know, it's not just people that...
Right. It's not like these are his buddies that he's, you know, sort of like,
you know,
like Clinton did.
That's been one criticism of the two-term limit rule, that a sitting president has 4 years to exercise that power with no check on it whatsoever. On the other hand, if it was deemed to be corrupt or something, the president is still subject to impeachment.
Well, I think, yeah,
before that time occurs.
I think the check is sort of the political process, or at least that's the theory, you know, that not only would the country be up in arms over some sort of, you know, abuse of that power, but certainly the Congress would shut him down. So.
Well, I think I know that there have been, you know, tens of thousands of petitions submitted. And in fact, the Obama administration has a task force committee, a group of lawyers that are vetting these things to make sure that they're getting the right ones and presenting them. By the time they get to the president, they've already been investigated, looked at, and a lot of other things that happen. And a lot of these folks don't have lawyers. I was kind of surprised that the grant rate, if you want to call it that, is – you know, pretty much evenly spread amongst those that are filing pro se petitions and those that are represented by counsel.
Is that right?
So I'd like to believe that lawyers can play an important part of that process, which I know they can, but it
not,
also
not just be potted plants.
Correct. Or chopped liver or whatever.
Chopped liver, right.
Yeah. What am I over here? Chopped liver?
You know, sometimes you feel that way. Sometimes you feel, as an attorney, that that there's nothing you can do for your client. For example, when you're in the federal system, there's a lot of times you're faced with a situation where there's little you can do other than to tell your client that he better be a snitch or he's going to go away for an obscenely long time because only the – you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, of course.
We've both been in that situation, and I hate it because you feel rather powerless. And your client is even more powerless because they're the one that has to do the time, you know, or become the snitch.
I have positive and negative feelings about that. The reason that I have a slightly positive feeling is that in that situation, it is the client's choice and it's never mine. I will never tell a client that it's, you know, what to do when it comes to snitching or anything
Well, sure, of course not. Yeah.
And, of course, the negative feeling I have about it is that it makes it so the evidence that is used against a person becomes irrelevant. The manner in which it was gathered is irrelevant. Trial rights, et cetera, become irrelevant. It's all about who can point the finger fastest and at the most people.
Yeah, you know, and – oh, this really – you just – have touched a nerve here, because you look at the quality of the evidence, say in those drug cases that we're talking, that snitches are, of course, a routine part. The quality is terrible. I mean, sure, the reports are written by some agents who, of course, dress it up in agent talk. But at the end of the day, if you were to really challenge these guys, you could just rip them apart. I'll give you a perfect example. I have a drug case right now where my client's cousin talks my client into accepting a package for him. And because he was getting something for his kids, and my client didn't really question it. And so he accepts it. And of course, it's, you know, high grade marijuana, a large amount. And they had they had what's called an anticipatory search warrant. And for those who don't know what that is, that's upon the delivery of the package, the search warrant becomes active. So of course, that's what happens. He gets arrested, and he's like, I didn't know what it was. And he insists he's been offered probation and he will not take it. And I love him for it. And yesterday we had an evidentiary hearing where two of the agents who questioned him and then claimed that he consented to a search of his phone, testified. And I'll tell you what, I am so, so happy that we finally had the chance to challenge some of these, you know, almighty federal officers, because they were horrible. They were tripping all over themselves. Their stories were totally contradictory. And I think the government's attorney, who's a young guy, was kind of back on his heels because he's not used to anybody challenging them. Right. And I guess if there's a moral to this story is, start to challenge these people. You know, I mean, if you're an attorney listening to this, you know, take your cases to trial. You know, the aura of invincibility that the government likes to portray, and government at all levels, but certainly at the federal level, you know, is kind of a myth. And I know I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, Kirk, but. This is really, it's upsetting to me, because the way that the law is structured at the federal level in particular is that, all the power resides in the prosecutor. So they get to decide what the charge is. And of course, they wait until the drug weights are really high. So the penalties are really high and there's mandatory minimums. And then the only way to get under the mandatory minimums is to agree to cooperate.
Right. And that goes into their charging decisions as well, because if it's premised on the fact that they can anticipate that there will be snitching and cooperation, that's why they charge people with large-scale conspiracies that have small roles. And then, you know what I mean? The person has everything to gain and nothing to lose by snitching, and frankly is given free license to make up stories all they want. But, you know, one thing that – just to follow up on a point you were making – when our criminal justice system was born, it was envisioned as a robust stallion. And what's happened is, because we haven't taken the stallion out to get exercised now and then, it's turned into a swayback nag. And
it's quite a visual that you're giving us.
Just made that up on the spot.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
swayback.
Swayback nag.
Nag, okay.
But my point is that, you know, we're not challenging the system as much as it should be. And that's part of justice. That's part of keeping the system healthy, is that, you know, we should never have an attitude from a judge or a prosecutor, and certainly not a defense lawyer, that business as usual means you roll over and just don't fight. You know,
well, that's but yet that's what we see in courtrooms across the country. I'm sure you see it in Sheboygan, if you walk on the sixth floor of the Milwaukee County Courthouse, there's just a long stream of lawyers filling out plea forms for their clients.
Right.
And you know, and maybe in a lot of those cases, it's the best thing for the client. Maybe they got a great deal. Maybe they couldn't pass it up. But there's very few times when I see an aggressive attitude by a defense attorney. Really eager to take a case to trial. And, when I do see that, I'm encouraged, but I guess it's few and far between, more and more these days. I don't know what you see.
I understand there are people that It depends on your personality. There are people that are uncomfortable in that situation. And hey, trust me, the system is designed such that if you're a defense lawyer that doesn't have a strong backbone, you're going to feel uncomfortable because the judge will act like you're crazy if you want to take a case to trial. The prosecutor will act like you're doing something wrong, you know, by taking the case to trial or fighting it or exercising your client's rights. So yeah, it takes guts and it takes you got to have a thick skin. And frankly, it's something that I wear with pride in the courtroom when I don't get along with everybody else that's in the courtroom. I don't think I should.
No,
I don't think I should be buddies with a prosecutor or anything
like
that.
It's not our job to get along. You know what? And this reminds me of a federal case I tried years ago where we had four co-defendants. And I was sitting there with my client who was the kingpin. And the other attorneys were all like, you know, just chatting it up. And with the prosecutor when we had downtime or whatever. And I just sat there with my client and went over stuff with him. But they were like basically kissing up. And and I was like, really? Is this,
How's your son's softball team?
What do you think your client sitting there thinks about you? Exactly. Do you think your client thinks that you're fighting for him or are you fighting for yourself and your career?
You know, that's logical. That's a logical point. But, you know, when people feel that social pressure or the internal systemic pressure to play nice, that seems to overcome the concern for the client and what the client is thinking.
Yeah.
In that situation.
I'm all about playing nice and being professional. But I want my client to know and know that he knows that I'm there for him and only him. Or her,
right.
You know, and that I don't want them to have the impression or lose confidence. I want them to have confidence in me and I want them to know that I care about them and right. Not just about, you know, my own well-being, as it were. But anyways, okay, that's the end of my rant.
All right, good.
I think we're coming up on a break.
We are. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Hey, John, there was an article in the newspaper a couple weeks ago, and I know most people here in Sheboygan saw it. But I think it was one of those articles that was through the Gannett system, so you may have seen it down there too.
Yeah.
But it talked about
Gannett pretty much owns everything, don't they?
Yeah, it's like the empire of all media. I don't know. That's not a bad thing necessarily. It's just that, you know, our local paper here has very little original creative stories.
That's one of the downfalls of having these large conglomerations, but we'll talk about this after you tell me about the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, anyway. But we had a judge for many years here, Judge Bolgert.
I know. Yep.
James Bolgert. He retired recently, and they got the idea to sort of do a statistical analysis comparing sentences all over the state to his in particular. And the article alleged that he was
soft on crime.
Way an outlier, like way out. Far away from everything. But I wanted to at least tell our listeners that are familiar with this article and familiar with Judge Bolgert that it was really an unfair article in the sense that doing a study of that nature, first of all, has really nothing to do with whether a judge is soft on crime, tough on crime, etc., because it's naturally skewed. And I'll tell you why. If you read the article carefully, the district attorney, Joseph DiCecco, admitted something that I thought they weren't supposed to admit, but maybe I'm wrong about that. He said that they basically were engaging in judge shopping for, you know, the entire time that Judge Bolgert was on the bench. They would save the cases where they wanted someone to go to prison until Judge Bolgert wasn't on intake, okay, because they feared that he would be too lenient and, you know, the real thing about Judge Bolgert that I think people don't understand is that he was a very independent thinker, and he really thought hard, long and hard, about what the right thing to do was. He gathered more information than many other judges do. He considered both sides of the argument. And by and large, what ended up happening was the DA's office played the old shoot high, aim low or aim high, shoot low, you know, philosophy, where they'd go in there asking for three times as much as what they really wanted, figuring the judge was going to undercut them. That had the effect of the judge realizing that they were out of whack with what they were asking for, and he reeled them in with something reasonable. But also, you got to remember, the ones that were going to him because of this judge shopping phenomenon were less serious crimes to begin with.
Right.
Because they were keeping the more serious crimes away from that judge. So to put together a bunch of numbers and say that, hey, this judge doesn't send people to prison as much as others. The problem, if you want to call it one, comes from the DA's office. Not only that, but we all know, and if you haven't learned by now, based on being awake and in the world and not living under a rock, you've heard this a million times, but every case is different. And as soon as we start losing sight of that essential component of our justice system, that you simply cannot punch in the crime and punch in the person, you know,
right.
Some other
statistics
and have a, you know, computer spit out the sentence, kind of like the sentencing guidelines. You know?
Exactly. That's what I was going
to
say.
But if we want to go towards a system like that to – you know, what are we doing? I mean, why do we even have judges?
Well, isn't that the that's the rationale underlying mandatory minimums. We can't trust these judges to give what we think should be the sentence, so we're just going to create it ourselves.
Well, that's the purported rationale. The real rationale behind it is that it helps a politician get elected because it doesn't matter what really happens in court. What matters is that they can claim that they took a tough stance on a particular issue and said, see, we're sending more people to prison. Hypothetical people to prison. Now, when it really comes to what you actually do and a judge is hindered in some way, and there are, let's not forget, a crime as charged almost always falls on a spectrum. Even things like, you know, bank robbery. You might think, oh, that's just awful. Well, what if the person attempted it and was not successful because they really hadn't thought it out, or they were, you know, high on drugs and needed treatment for that? Or what if they didn't use violence or didn't use a note? Or what if they thought of it at the last minute because
their brother talked them into it or whatever?
That versus driving a truck loaded with dynamite through the front door of a bank and killing 20 people. I mean, that's all bank robbery, right? You know, it's on a spectrum. But that applies really to just about every case, and that's why we have judges, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. I think for bank robbery that you should get extra years if you're super stupid, like my client who was, you know, I mean, Milwaukee's a pretty racially divided city, so he's a black gentleman from the north side. Him and his brother take a bus down to very white South Milwaukee, and mm-hmm. they rob a bank down there on a Saturday morning.
Right.
And
take the bus back?
No, they were going to take the bus back, but he decided to call his girlfriend on his Chirp phone, which is like using a speaker, and he's walking around this little lily-white community looking very out of place, practically yelling at her on the phone to come pick him up, you know, and swearing.
Because he just robbed a bank.
And he's walking past all these people's houses, and they could all hear him, even though it was wintertime and they had their windows closed. And so, he actually gets away, but he dropped his scarf and they got DNA off of it, and so they got a hit and they found him. So
wow. I'm just like, I thought you were going to say he took an Uber X, you know, from the scene. Your Uber will be here in 3 minutes. Oh, that's not fast.
That's
enough.
That's not fast enough. I'm using Lyft next time.
Oh man, but anyway, I just wanted to make sure that you know, when the news gets a hold of a story like, you know, the justice system and fear. I mean, they don't talk about judges being too harsh ever. I mean, that's never a news story. That's never something that you
that's sort of implicitly approved of. I'll tell you, you know, I wasn't in front of Jim Bolgert a lot, but I had enough to have a flavor for him as a judge. And having done this for 27 years, I know what makes a good judge. And I think some of the qualities that you just discussed are, I think, appropriate for him. I think he was thoughtful. This is just based on my experience, but I thought he was very thoughtful. And he's patient. And I thought he was even-handed. You know, and all components, that's really what you want in a judge, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's what the prosecution should want as well. I mean, we as a community would want that. We would want a judge who is cognizant of not only the expectations, decorum, and of the courtroom, but also the respect due to citizens that appear in front of a tribunal where everybody but the defense lawyer in most cases, well, even sometimes the defense lawyer, are public servants. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think Mr. Tichecko's, who was a law school classmate of mine, by the way, I think one of his complaints is that he filed a lot of bad cases and people like Bolger dismissed them. Because I had one of them.
And, as they should be.
Yeah, and he was going to refile and he didn't because he knew he couldn't make the case. And glass houses and stones and all that, I don't know. Just an observation, but that's...
Yeah. And then, of course, you see a lot of the online comments to articles and... Oh, boy, I don't even want to get into that, but it reminds me of all the fake news that's going around lately. Oh, yeah, by the way.
Speaking of that.
Pizzagate. That was just phenomenal. Well, sad that somebody acted on fake news, and I think mentally deficient in some ways. I mean, there had to be something going on where the guy's going to go and shoot a gun at a pizza place. I mean,
well, you know what? He did even more. He found he fired a bullet at a door that he thought was like a secret tunnel to funnel the children. Yes. It turned out to be a closet with a computer hard drive in it, which of course got shot also. I mean, but this is actually a fascinating thing, sort of a criminal case to have this discussion, because there was an investigative reporter that actually looked into some of these fake news articles and discovered that there's this guy out in California who is sort of like a one-man factory for producing these.
I read about that.
You did? Yeah. And he gets other people to work for him. He makes like $10,000 to $30,000 a month.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that there's money to be made in fake news. You know what? We've always said you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. It's a cliche, practically. I mean, when you're talking about – it's usually in the context of whether you can exercise free speech, et cetera.
Right.
But you can't do something that results in harm to people around you because of what you say. And I don't just mean hurting people's feelings. I mean something that actually causes others – to be harmed because of what you've said or done. And that could be disorderly conduct. It could be something a lot worse than that. It could be, inciting – it could be reckless conduct. So why can't we have – and we should soon, I hope, have some laws that criminalize blatantly false news sources? Now, I don't want to lose the Onion. Don't get me wrong.
Right. No, well, that's satire.
But that's satire.
That's – I'm with you on this, but I don't know how we structure that.
Well, let's talk about it when we come back from the break, because now it's time to listen to our sponsors. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John on WHBL. And
are you doing all right there? Because you took a deep breath as though
I was absorbing the festive atmosphere of the season, and and of course the thrill of this discussion. So that sort of left me in awe.
Well, getting back to what we were talking about before,
sure.
When it's the Onion or National Lampoon, for that matter. The satire is obvious, and they've branded themselves as a satirical.
Well, sure.
News piece. They're
never, kind of proud of it, actually. Yeah. That's kind of the whole point.
And that's part of the humor behind it. And we as Americans love satire. I mean, it's something that is, very, very pronounced as part of our culture. And, it's a sign of intellectual stimulation when you understand what's so funny about something being off the wall that way. But when news sources claim to be legit, and I do think that if someone were to look at the problems that it has created, one could argue that one who maliciously spreads a false news article with intent to either, you know, influence an election or cause people to do something, even insofar that they may be spending money for, at, you know, for whatever, if it guides yeah. somebody in some way. I mean, it smacks of fraud. It's something that we all get upset by, as a matter of fact. Even the people that were duped into thinking that the news story was real, that's horribly embarrassing. I mean, it hasn't happened to me. I will tell you this, though. One thing that is legit, and I'm so glad about this, this is actually going to be my last show on WHBL because the Prince of Nigeria has contacted me via email, and I have...
I was wondering when he was going to make his way.
$190 billion U.S. dollars. All I got to do is send him $1 million.
By the way, you're welcome, because I just did that deal, and then I gave him your name.
Oh, good. You passed.
So you're welcome.
I don't know if I ever told you this story, but years ago, when that first started happening, and you know, like, hey, I'm a Marine in, you know, Yemen, and I've stumbled across an ancient mummy, and I want to ship it to you. You know, back when those things first started happening, I sent out this email to our Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers listserv, and I was like, I'm finally able to say how much I hate all of you people. You've been nothing but discourteous to me, and I can't wait to see you and your miserable lives spent an eternity in hell. Ha-ha, see you later, suckers.
So,
I'm going to be rich. And then after that, I'm like, dear friends, I appear to have been mistaken about my
newfound wealth.
My newfound wealth.
Yes. Well, I have to confess, and I'll just embarrassingly admit publicly here that the first time I read one of those like Nigerian prince things, I sort of like I read the whole thing, and I was like, okay, maybe I should contact this guy, and then I of course shook my head and woke myself out of my little fantasy. But
I had a client.
It sucks you in.
Who was going to hire me? He didn't have the money to put down, but he assured me that there was quite a windfall coming his way that would fund his defense.
Is it his civil rights case?
It didn't happen the way he thought it would. Let's put it that
way.
Okay,
yeah.
And I knew better. I had to – this guy, he thought he was a real big shot. Like, he thought that he was such an important person that he actually was being contacted by, you know, whomever. I had to break it to him that he's not that much of a hotshot. So,
can I jump on something here that's kind of like, I've been raising my cackles. Okay, you know how much I love Sheriff David Clark, right?
Oh, yeah, you're buds.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I'll tell you as an aside to this story he was trying to get somebody prosecuted who was criticizing him, one of the Board of County Supervisor members. But I was in court the other day, and of course the deputies run the courtrooms in Milwaukee County, and we were talking about, you know, what he's going to be running Homeland Security or is doing some other job, you know, because after he interviewed with Trump, and made some comment about who was going to replace him, and the deputy's like, I've got a drawer full of stuff in my on this guy, and he's not going to replace him. And so it's like, you know, it's David Clark's going to leave in his wake a completely broken department, I think.
Makes you think it's not broken now, for heaven's sake?
Well, no, absolutely. No, absolutely. Because he hadn't hired new deputies for like 10 years. He just kept using because he wanted to save money, you know.
Why does he spend so much money on cowboy hats then?
My God, so true. So anyways, there's this county supervisor named Supreme Moore Omokundi, and I believe it's Gwen Moore's son, who was actually arrested in 2004 for slashing the tires of some Republican activists or something like that.
I remember that. I absolutely remember that, yeah.
So, but he says, he tells the Journal Sentinel in a news release, he says, something is terribly wrong at the county jail, at the Mauk County Jail, and Sheriff David Clark needs to resign before more people die, because there was 4 deaths in the 6-month period under
factual,
his watch.
Factual.
And he says he's unfit to lead and blah, blah, blah. So the sheriff comes back, of course, and he says that he thinks this guy should be investigated and maybe even...
We're just making up, fill in the blank?
Yeah, I think something like that, yeah. This is a voting rights violation that should have been prosecuted in federal court. That was the old case. Mm. He should have been sent to a federal prison. If he had been a Ku Klux Klansman, he would have been, he says. There's no equal justice under the law. This was lowballed because of who his mommy is. That's what Clark said.
Wow.
So... this is, I, you know, given his manner of handling himself, he's exactly like Donald Trump, just off the cuff, purposely says crazy things. And I have to believe he's going to be, there's going to be some position in this administration for him. No, I'm serious.
A match made in heaven.
Well, I mean, look at who else he's got. Mad Dog. General Mad Dog, whatever his name is.
Does Sheriff Clark have any nicknames that you can insert in the middle of his name, like, you know?
I don't know. Let's come up with one right now. Let's see.
David Mad Dog Clark. No, that's already taken.
Oh. Yeah, damn it. Let's see. He's not, it's got to have something to do with a horse and a cowboy hat.
All right, well, we'll come back to that later. Hey,
all right.
You and I were talking earlier about a Fourth Circuit case that had
yes.
to do with sex offender restrictions.
Yeah, so this actually ties back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of how laws are written or how they're constructed constitutionally, whether they're clear enough. And so the Fourth Circuit, the federal Fourth Circuit, strikes down a North Carolina law that said that sex offenders could not be let's see. They couldn't be on the premises of any daycare. They couldn't be within 300 feet of any daycare. And they couldn't be at any place where minors gather for regularly scheduled educational, recreational, or social programs. So the court's like, okay, no sex offender or law enforcement officer knows what that last one means because we don't know. We can't define where they regularly gather, what's regularly, regularly scheduled. Who's going to define that? It's, you know, and they just threw it out on its ear because, and the interesting part is going to be to see what the Supremes do on this because they've upheld these in the past, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know what the limits are in terms of how strict they can be made. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a problem with if you look at the purpose behind such regulation. I think ideally, at least those that think it's a good idea to limit where certain people can live and what they can do. You don't want it to be too narrow because then there might be ways for people to argue that they don't fit within that classification. I think that's by design when they say like things like regularly, et cetera. You know,
by design to allow expansive use of it
right.
by the
Correct.
Cops. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, okay. I'll give you an example. This is an issue that I've been seeing much more frequently, and we've only got about 30 seconds left, so maybe I'll just give an intro to it and we can come back to it next week. But, you know, one of the reasons that a person may not possess a firearm and a question that they ask people when they are purchasing a firearm, among the many on the sheet that you have to fill out, is are you a user or an addict of a controlled substance?
I have a story about this when we talk about it next time.
Yeah, we'll talk about it next time. But I've been seeing this crop up, you know, quite a bit here and there. So we'll talk about that next week. A little teaser to keep you tuned. So we hope you've enjoyed the show. It's been another episode of Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Hey, everybody, have a great weekend. Go Pack, go.
Have a great day.